Many's the hour I've lain by my window and thought of the people who've carried the burdens, who marched into strange fields in search of an answer and ended their journeys an unwilling hero. So here's a song to those who are gone with never a reason why, and a toast of the wine at the end of the line, and a toll of the bell for the next one to die.
Phil Oakes had watched the optimism of the 60s devolve into the darkness and cynicism of the 70s. His own music career had fizzled out, while that of his one-time friend and peer, Bob Dylan, had exploded. By 1975, Phil Oakes had developed a severe drinking problem, and his behavior became increasingly erratic. He frightened his friends with his drunken rants about the FBI or the CIA spying on him. In mid-1975, Phil Oakes adopted an alter ego. He started calling himself John Butler Train. He told people that John Butler Train had murdered Phil Oakes and that he, John Butler Train, had replaced him. John Butler Train was convinced that somebody was trying to kill him, so he carried a weapon at all times, a knife, sometimes a hammer. He was always drunk, getting into bar fights, and he eventually ended up living on the streets. His friends tried to help him, and his brother Michael even attempted to have him committed to a psychiatric hospital. After several months, the John Butler Train persona faded and Phil Oakes returned, but he openly talked about suicide, disturbing his friends and family further. In January of 1976, Phil Oakes moved to Far Rockaway to live with his sister, Sonny. His only activities were watching television and playing cards with his nephews. He finally saw a psychiatrist and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and he was prescribed medication, and he told his sister he was taking it. But he wasn't. And on April 9th, 1976, Phil Oakes committed suicide by hanging himself in Sonny's home. Years after his death, it was revealed that the FBI actually was spying on Phil Oakes at the height of his counterculture fame. They had a 500-page file on Phil Oakes. The song we heard at the beginning of this episode, it's from a 1986 Rhino compilation of previously unreleased material released posthumously or after Phil Oakes' death. That's what we will be hearing on today's episode. Songs that were released after the artist's death or posthumously.
And a toast of the wine at the end of the line, and a toll of the bell for the next one to die.
Program for a special news bulletin. Three young singers who soared to the heights of show business on the current rock and roll craze were killed today in the crash of a light plane in an Iowa snow flurry.
There comes a time for everybody when true love will come your way. There comes a time for everybody. What they tell me, that's what they say. I didn't hear them say a word of when that time will be. I only know that what they say has not come true for me. You just keep waiting and love will come your way. That's what they tell me, that's what they say. Say a word of when that time will be. I'll just keep waiting and love will come your way. That's what they tell me, that's what they say. That's what they tell me, that's what they say.
That was a song by Buddy Holly, originally recorded as an acoustic demo in his apartment in New York in 1959, overdubbed later by producer Jack Hansen, and released posthumously in 1960 on the Buddy Holly Story, Volume 2. Shortly after 12:55 a.m. on February 3rd, 1959, Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson, and pilot Roger Peterson were killed instantly when their plane crashed into a frozen cornfield 5 miles northwest of the Mason City, Iowa airport shortly after the plane took off. Buddy Holly was 22. Richie Valens was only 17. Let's hear a song by Richie Valens that was released on the second of three posthumous albums. This came out in February of 1960 on an album called Richie. This is a song called My Darling Is Gone.
Well, my darling's gone. I'm left all alone. I miss her so. My nights are so lonely. I cried on my own, 'cause my darling's gone. I don't know what I'll do when the day that she left me, I never been the same, 'cause I love my darling. Never be the same. My nights were so lonely. I cried all night long, 'cause my darling.
On December 10th, 1967, Otis Redding's plane crashed into Lake Monona in Madison, Wisconsin. He was on his way there to play a gig at the factory. Otis Redding was 26 years old. A record called The Immortal Otis Redding was released posthumously in June of 1968 by Atco Records. It compiled 11 songs recorded by Otis Redding in a 3-week stretch. These sessions concluded just days prior to his death. Let's hear a song from those sessions released after Otis's death. This is a song called The 1,000 Miles Away.
Away, yeah, sure enough. love you, honey. Yeah. Oh. Lord, I'm suffering, God. From your heart. Ooh. What's mine, baby, is yours. I want you to get it, baby, but you a thousand miles away, 1,000. Ooh, I can't give it to you, honey. Yeah, honey. No, you got me suffering, baby. Can't see you, honey. I don't want to hear from you. Don't call me on the phone, baby. I love you. I want to see you, girl.
On September 20th, 1973, during Jim Croce's Life and Times tour, and the day before his new single, I Got a Name, was to be released, Jim Croce and all five others on board were killed when their chartered Beechcraft jet crashed into a tree during takeoff. He was just 30 years old. An investigation showed that the twin-engine plane crashed after clipping a pecan tree at the end of the runway. The pilot had failed to gain sufficient altitude to clear the tree. Since he had not tried to avoid it, it was concluded that, because of poor visibility, he just didn't see it. Jim Croce's fifth and final studio album, I Got a Name, was released 2 months after his death. This is the last song on that record. It's called The Hard Way Every Time.
You've had my share of broken dreams and more than a couple of falls, and in chasing what I thought were moonbeams, I have run into a couple of walls. But in looking back at the places I've been, the changes that I've left behind, I just look at myself to find. I learn the hard way every time. Cause I've had my share of good intentions and I made my share of mistakes. And I've learned at times it's best to bend, cause if you don't, well, those are the breaks. Should have listened to all the things I was told, but I was young and too proud at the time. Now I look at myself to find. But in looking back at the lessons I've learned from the mountains I wanted to climb, I just look at myself to find. I learn the hard way every time. Cause I've had my share of broken dreams and more than a couple of falls. And in chasing what I thought were moonbeams, I have run into a couple of walls. But in looking back at the faces I've been, I would sure be the first one to say, when I look at myself today, wouldn't have done it any other way.
You can hear the entire Badfinger story on episode 17 of the podcast, but suffice it to say, the band was amazing and poised for greatness, and a despicable career criminal manager named Stan Polly stole it from them. Polly disappeared with the band's last advance from Warner Brothers, and they had nothing left. Their once incredibly promising career seemed destroyed. Believing his finances had been completely wiped out, Pete Ham hanged himself in his garage 3 days before his 28th birthday. He left a note telling his pregnant wife and her son that he loved them. It read, quote, "I will not be allowed to love and trust everybody. This is better. P.S. Stan Polly is a soulless bastard." Rykodisc released two posthumous CD compilations of demo material recorded by Pete Ham. The first one was called 7 Park Avenue. This is an amazing song from that CD by Pete Ham. It's called Live, Love All of Your Days. November of 1988, Roy Orbison had completed work on what was supposed to be his comeback album, Mystery Girl. It was his first studio album in almost 10 years. The Travelin' Wilburys Volume 1 was a hit, and he was poised for a comeback. Around this time, Roy Orbison confided in Johnny Cash that he was having chest pains, and he said he would have to do something about his health, but he never really did. His career was buzzing. He went to Europe, was presented with an award there. He played a show in Antwerp where footage for his video for You Got It was filmed. He gave several interviews per day. It was a hectic schedule. A few days later, a manager at a club in Boston was concerned about him. He looked ill, but Roy Orbison still played the show and got a standing ovation. Exhausted, he returned home to rest for a few days before flying to London to film two more videos for the Traveling Wilburys. On December 6, 1988, he spent the day flying model airplanes with his sons and ate dinner at his mother's home. Later that day, he died of a heart attack. He was only 52. Let's hear a song from that album that was finished before Roy died but not released until after his death. This was co-written by Diane Warren. It's called Careless Heart.
Still be loving me if not for my care.
It was September of 1973. Gram Parsons, out in the California desert, had consumed large amounts of alcohol and barbiturates. After downing 6 double tequilas, he purchased some morphine from an unknown young woman, and she injected him in his hotel room, and he overdosed. His panicked friends gave him an ice cube suppository and later a cold shower. Then they put him to bed and went out to buy some coffee, hoping that would revive him. His respiration became irregular, and eventually they attempted CPR, then finally decided to call an ambulance. Gram Parsons was declared dead on arrival at High Desert Memorial Hospital at 12:15 a.m. on September 19th, 1973. The official cause of death was an overdose of morphine and alcohol. The amount of morphine in Gram Parsons' system would have been lethal to 3 regular people. Gram Parsons' second solo album was already done at this time, but it came out after his death. It's called Grievous Angel. Let's hear a song from that record. This is Gram Parsons and In My Hour of Darkness.
Young man went driving through the night, miles and miles without a word, but just his high beam lights.
Who'd have ever thought they'd build such a deadly Denver bend, to be so strong, to take so long as it would.
Silver string guitar, and he played to people everywhere. they never missed a page.
And I loved him like my father, and I loved him like my friend, and I knew his time would shortly come, but I did not know just when. In my hour of darkness,
during the early morning hours of November 25th, 1974, Nick Drake died at his home from an overdose of amitriptyline, an antidepressant. He was 26. Nick Drake had gone to bed early after spending the afternoon visiting a friend. His mother said that around dawn, he left his room for the kitchen, where they assumed he ate some cereal. He returned to his room and took some pills to help him sleep. His family was accustomed to him keeping odd hours, but eventually his mother went to check on him. She found him dead in his bed. The coroner would rule his death a suicide, but this was disputed by some of his friends, most of his family. But many of them did agree that, accidental or not, Nick Drake seemed to have given up on life. In 1987, Rykodisc released a great compilation of unreleased Nick Drake material called Time of No Reply. Let's hear a great song from that. This was recorded in July of 1974. It's called Hanging on a Star.
When you deem me so high, when you deem me so high, when you deem me so high. And why leave me sailing in the sea? When you hear me so clear, when you hear me so clear, when you hear me so clear.
Sandy Denny was most famous for her time in the folk group Fairport Convention. By 1976, she was manic and depressive. Learning she was pregnant did little to slow down Sandy Denny's reckless lifestyle, which was heightened by increasing depression, mood swings, and the unraveling of her marriage. She abused drugs and alcohol even when she was pregnant, and her daughter Georgia was born prematurely in July of 1977. Denny had become self-destructive, and her friends would later note that she had a history of purposefully throwing herself off of bar stools and down flights of stairs in order to get attention or a reaction. In late March of 1978, while she was on holiday with her parents and her baby, Georgia, she fell down the stairs, hit her head on the concrete. Following the incident, she suffered from intense headaches, and doctors prescribed painkillers. At some point during April of 1978, Denny suffered yet another major fall at her home. Her husband left her at this point, and she went to stay with a friend. She was abusing the painkillers and drinking alcohol, and eventually Sandy Denny fell into a coma from which she never recovered. Who Knows Where the Time Goes is a retrospective compilation released in 1985. This is a Sandy Denny song released posthumously from that compilation called Take Away the Load.
This evening, John Lennon arrived at the emergency room at the Roosevelt Hospital. He was dead at the time of his arrival. Numerous resuscitative efforts were made after his arrival in the hospital, including transfusions, surgical procedures, other procedures. But in spite of the effort of many physicians and after many procedures, we were unable to restore the life of Mr. Lennon.
Time has come. will not end.
That song, Grow Old With Me, was from the John Lennon and Yoko album Milk and Honey, released after John Lennon's murder. By 1976, the sensational Alex Harvey Band's fortunes were on the decline, and then their manager was killed in a plane crash. Alex Harvey was battling poor health and alcoholism. His band broke up in October of 1977. He tried to reboot the band with other members, even tried to get the original band back together. Nothing really worked out. Years of hard living finally took its toll on Alex, and he succumbed to a heart attack on February 4th, 1982, the day before his 47th birthday. He had finished recording an album before his death that came out after his death in 1983. It's called The Soldier on the Wall. This is a song from that album by Alex Harvey. It's called The Poet and I.
Like Robert Burns, and my words flowed free. If I could write like Robert Burns, I'd give my life to thee. If I could paint a picture of the bird of Scotia Shore, the poet and I would be as one. I would not ask for more. We would sing of high. A red, red rose. The poet and I would walk the way and sit on the banks of the dawn. The poet and I would write of him and walk by the light of the moon. From the winter's blast and talk of Tam O'Shanter and think about the past. We would say of Highland Mary and follow where she goes.
On the night of September 16, 1977, Vicky Arum, a nightclub singer, met Mark Bolan and his girlfriend Gloria Jones at a party, and they invited her back to their home. She followed them in a separate car, thus she witnessed the crash that would kill Mark Bolan. The story was told for years that the car Bolan was a passenger in crashed into a sycamore tree, but according to Vicky Arum, a witness to the crash, he was in fact killed when the car hit a steel-reinforced fence post, and Bolan suffered a horrific head injury. Vicky Arum described how she was driving just seconds behind the car when it crashed. Quote, "As I came over the bridge, I can still in my mind see so clearly a purple car which looked like a little beetle. It was upright, and it was smoking, and there was a tiny glimmer of light from the moon. The night was so still. I said, 'We've got to get them out. This car might blow up.' I took my mother's rug from the back of my car and put it on the ground. Some of the fans are comforted by the fact that he was laid on a nice lady's rug." Gloria Jones, who was driving, survived the crash. In an eerie parallel to Mark Bolan's death, Vicky Arum crashed into a tree on the way to give evidence at an inquest about the crash. People didn't realize there was a fence between the tree that they thought the car hit and the road because the fence was removed after the crash. There is damage on the tree, but it was too high up to actually have been from the car. So the car crashed into a fence, and a post from the fence, apparently, is what killed Mark Bolan. In 1982, a record was released called Billy Super Duper, which is a compilation of songs that Bolan recorded before his death, but were not released until after his death. Let's hear a song from that record called Foxy Boy.
Girl, won't you move? Thank you.
Tommy Bolin recorded his second solo album, Private Eyes, in June of 1976. Then Deep Purple, of which he was a member, broke up in July. Private Eyes came out in September. Tommy Bolin's plan was to finish a tour in support of Private Eyes, opening for Jeff Beck, and then get to work on his next album, which was supposed to be a more R&B-based album, and it was going to be called I Got to Dance. On December 4th, 1976, Tommy Bolin and his band had just performed a set in Miami, Florida. Afterward, his bass player, Jimmy Haslip, left him backstage offering some advice. Quote, I told him to be careful. When I left, I heard that there was an entourage of people that ended up in Tommy's hotel room, and there was some party going on. And that's when, from what I understand, there was a major problem. Tommy passed out, and basically, his body was being deprived of oxygen for some reason. He was turning blue. Supposedly, right away, somebody wanted to call 911, but this guy who was sent to be Tommy's babysitter put a halt to it and said, I'll take care of him. The guy was an ex-Marine drill sergeant. He probably had skills in saving people's lives, the skills that a paramedic might know. If you bring in an ambulance with paramedics, that's going to bring a lot of publicity. So maybe he was trying to protect Tommy from any kind of strange publicity like that, trying to revive him on his own. They supposedly threw him in the bathtub and started pouring cold water over him to try to bring him back into consciousness. From what I understood, his color came back and he was breathing fairly normally. Then they got him into bed and he started turning blue again, and I think at that point in time they did call 911. But by then it was too late, and when the paramedics got there, they could not bring Tommy back. Tommy Bolin died from an overdose of heroin and other substances, including alcohol, cocaine, and barbiturates. There are several posthumous releases by Tommy Bolin. I'm going to play you a song from a 1996 release called From the Archives, Volume 1. This is called Meaning of Love. Peter Lafner was in the very important Cleveland band Rocket from the Tombs, which split off into the Dead Boys and Pere Ubu. And Peter Lafner was also an early member of Pere Ubu. He was also a big rock fan. He wrote for Cream magazine, and he was close friends with Lester Bangs. But Lafner also had severe drug and alcohol abuse problems, and this eventually led to his death from acute pancreatitis in 1977, and he was only 24. Lester Bangs wrote a eulogy for him, simply titled, "Peter Lafner is Dead." Here's a quote from it. "Peter was in the hospital a lot during the last 2 years of his life, in fact. Around the time I moved to New York from Detroit, he called me up and told me that the doctors had informed him that he was going to die if he didn't stop all the drinking and the use of drugs. 'It's going to have to be Valium and grass from here on out,' he said. 'Shit, you gotta have something.' But it was also around this time that his midnight phone calls began to take on a creepy tinge. Sometimes he would be mush-mouthed on morphine or pain pills, sometimes hoarse from a few days' bout with speed and cognac and beer." In 1994, Tim Kerr Records released a compilation of unreleased Peter Lafner recordings. It's called Take the Guitar Player for a Ride. It's out of print and very rare now. This is a great song, basically a home recording, I think, by Peter Lafner. It's about the author of The Bell Jar who stuck her head in an oven. It's called Sylvia Plath.
Sylvia Plath was never too good at math, but they tell me that she finished at the head of her class. And if she lost any virginity, she didn't lose it too fast. They couldn't hold any dress rehearsals for Sylvia Plath. Came into Manhattan. She had crawled out of one cocoon where there was absolutely nothing happening. She said, "If I'm gonna be classless and crass, I'm gonna break up some glass." Nobody broke anything sharper than Sylvia Plath. No romance and excuses, it's just a dance in the aftermath. And when you check out of this hotel, Jack, you're nothing but an autograph. The desk clerk wakes up around 7 and he tosses it out with the trash. But he might keep around a couple of letters return addressed Sylvia Plath. Sylvia Plath woke up and turned on the gas. Then she put her head down and completely forgot about lighting a match. The rest of the details are just too boring to attach. But let's see you do one thing as graceful as Sylvia Plath. Oh, let's see you do one thing as graceful as Sylvia Plath. Yes, let's see you do one thing as senselessly cruel as Sylvia Plath.
In the year or so leading up to his death, Elliott Smith's output and physical mental health had begun to wane. He was reportedly smoking up to $1,500 worth of heroin and crack a day and exhibiting signs of paranoia. For example, he believed that DreamWorks executives were following him in a white van. After a disastrous set opening for Wilco in May of 2002, one reporter wrote, "It would not surprise me at all if Elliott Smith winds up dead within a year." But he made it to 2003, went into rehab, turned 34, made a decision to give up alcohol, caffeine, red meat, sugar, and his psych meds. He started to work on a new album. By September of 2003, when he played a free show at the University of Utah, he looked happy and healthy, but that would be his last show. On October 21st, 2003, Elliott Smith and his girlfriend, Jennifer Chiba, were arguing. She locked herself in the bathroom, supposedly to take a shower. Then she heard a scream. She opened the door and Elliott Smith was standing there with a knife in his chest. Chiba pulled the knife out of his chest and then called 911. Elliott supposedly left a note on a post-it that said, "I'm so sorry. Love, Elliott. God forgive me." He was pronounced dead at 1:36 p.m. He was 34 years old. While it was originally reported to be a suicide, the autopsy left open the possibility of homicide. There were no traces of illegal substances or alcohol in Elliott's system, just the prescribed levels of clonazepam, mirtazapine, atomoxetine, and amphetamines. What makes the coroner's report interesting is the fact that there were no hesitation wounds. But the coroner lists possible defense wounds on Elliott's hands. Another interesting fact is that less than a year after his death, Jennifer Chiba filed a lawsuit against his family for 15% of his earnings. She stated that the two lived together as husband and wife, and that he had pledged to take care of her financially for the rest of her life. There's been a lot of speculation about Chiba's actions in the days following Elliott Smith's death, particularly the fact that she fled the country on a one-way ticket to England, which was paid for by an ex-boyfriend. From a basement on the hill, Elliott Smith's final studio album was released posthumously in 2004. This is a song from it, called "A Distorted Reality Is Now a Necessity to Be Free."
Devil's script says
Atlantic Records was all set to release the debut studio album by Mother Love Bone called Apple in March of 1990. Then, on March 16th, Andrew Wood, frontman for Mother Love Bone, was found comatose by his girlfriend. He OD'd on heroin. He was taken to Harborview Hospital and placed on life support. The record was put on hold. Andrew Wood spent 2 days in the hospital. Friends and family got to say goodbye, and then he was taken off life support. Apple would be released 4 months later on July 19th. Let's hear a song from it called Bone China. On October 21st, 1995, Shannon Hoon, who had just attempted an unsuccessful stint in rehab right after the birth of his daughter, was found dead on Blind Melon's tour bus in New Orleans. Their second album, Soup, had only been out for 2 months. Shannon Hoon had just turned 28. A compilation called Nico was released posthumously in 1996. The album was named for Shannon Hoon's daughter, Nico Blue, and all proceeds from album sales were placed in a college trust for her. Let's hear a song from Nico by Blind Melon. This is called Pull. Joey Ramone died on Easter Sunday, April 15th, 2001, from lymphoma at New York Presbyterian Hospital, just a month before he would have turned 50 years old. His solo album, Don't Worry About Me, was released posthumously in 2002. Let's hear a song from it. This is Joey Ramone and Stop Thinking About It.
Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. The dwell is driving me crazy. Obsessing, don't you know what that's in? Yeah, you don't know what you want, but you want it. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. This world is driving me crazy. Baby, don't you know what that's in? Yeah, you don't know what you want. What you want.
Joe Strummer died of sudden cardiac arrest on December 22, 2002. He had an undiagnosed congenital heart defect. He collapsed at his Somerset home after returning from walking his dog, and his wife Lucinda found him and tried to revive him. Streetcore, the third and final studio album by his band Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros, was released after his death. It came out in October of 2003. Let's hear a song from it called Coma Girl.
I was crawling through a festival way out west. I was thinking about love and the acid test. At first I got real dizzy with a real rocking gang. And then I saw the Coma Girl on the excitement gang. The rain came in from the wide blue yonder. Through all the stages I wander. Oh, come on, girl, on the excitement gang. Mona Lisa on a motorcycle gang.
some fast food fanatic was burning down a burger van. Somebody was wailing out their head. Oh, nobody is ripping the teen scene dead. And the rain came in from the wide blue yonder. I thought you and me might wander. Oh, come, girl, and the excitement gang. On a motorcycle gang. Go, go. Go, go. On a motorcycle gang. As the 19th hour was falling upon Desolation Road, so my love band had the last drop on the go. Let's siphon up some gas. Let's get this show on the road. Said the coma girl to the excitement gang. Into action, everybody sprang. And the old drums were beating out. Doolang, doolang. Coma girl from the excitement gang. On a motorcycle gang. Come, girl. Lang, lang. Come, girl. Lang, lang. On a baby bomb, on a baby. Lang, lang. On a baby bomb, on a baby.
Freddie Mercury died of AIDS-related bronchial pneumonia on November 24, 1991, one day after issuing a public statement revealing that he was HIV positive, a diagnosis he'd been aware of since 1987. He was 45 years old. Freddie Mercury's close friend, Dave Clark, of the Dave Clark Five, was at his bedside when he died. Made in Heaven, the 15th album by Queen, was released after Freddie's death, came out in 1995. Following Freddie's death, Brian May, Roger Taylor, and John Deacon worked with vocal and piano parts that Mercury had recorded before his death, adding new instrumentation to the recordings. The album debuted at number one in the UK and sold 5 million copies. Let's hear a song from it. This is called Mother Love.
I want to long in my heart is heavy and my hope is gone. Out in the city, in the cold world outside, I don't want pity, just a safe place to hide. Mama, please let me back inside. I don't want to make no waves, but you can give me all the love that I crave. I can take it if you see me cry. I long for peace before I die. All I want is to know that you're there. You're gonna give me all your sweet mother love.
Phil Lynott collapsed at his home on Christmas Day 1985. He was discovered unconscious by his mother, who was not aware that he was addicted to heroin. She called his wife, who did know he was addicted to heroin. She drove over, took Phil to the hospital, where he was diagnosed with septicemia, a bacterial infection in the bloodstream that he probably contracted from dirty needles. Phil regained consciousness. He was able to speak to his mother in the hospital, but his condition worsened, and by New Year's Day, he was on a ventilator. He died of pneumonia and heart failure, complications of the septicemia, on January 4th, 1986. He was only 36 years old. In 1991, a compilation called Dedication, The Very Best of Thin Lizzy, was released. The compilation was named after a great song, Dedication, which was reconstructed after Phil's death using an 8-track demo recording of a Grand Slam song, which was the band he formed after Thin Lizzy broke up. The guitar player in that band was named Lawrence Archer, and we've actually heard a song by Lawrence on a previous AOR AOK episode. Well, when that compilation came out, Phil Lynott was given writing credit on that song, even though Lawrence Archer wrote it, so he sued, and he ended up getting his writing credit back for the song. Great job, Lawrence, because I love the song. So let's close out this episode with it. This is Grand Slam, Phil Lynott, Thin Lizzy, whatever. Great song, Dedication.
Thank you. medication. This is dedicated to the millions that are starving from hunger and dedication. Dedication. She stands, I give a dedication. 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 I dedicate it.
Back.